Hi there, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. I just spoke with Janice Neary about her really beautiful and very engaging recent book, The Insect and the Image, Visualizing Nature in Early Modern Europe, 1500 to 1700, that was published in 2011 with the University of Minnesota Press. Now, this is a book that uses a very focused case, the case of images of insects in early modernity, to talk about and to raise issues and help us rethink much larger categories and rethink the way we think in categories and rethink how we might not take certain categories for granted in our thinking. So this is a tall order, but one that is done really wonderfully in this book. Now, the categories that Neary asks us to rethink include art and science. They include amateur and professional. They include image and object. And she uses this very distinct case of insect imagery to show how in the work of not just a handful, more than a handful of artists who were working with and thinking with insects across early modernity, the sort of boundaries between the sort of fine arts and decorative arts, artistic and scientific practices, were really blurred. And the ways that some of these artists manipulated the way audiences thought about those categories by using a kind of visual rhetoric that really also helped them create certain kinds of professional personas. So this is also about not just changes in visual rhetoric or changes in the way the arts and the sciences came together in the figure of the insect in early modernity. It's also about transformations in the way practitioners were crafting their own personas in this context. It's really, really interesting. It's a beautiful book, and I hope you enjoy. Hello, Janice.
Hello, Carla.
We're here today to talk with Janice Neary about her recent book, The Insect and the Image, Visualizing Nature in Early Modern Europe, 1500 to 1700. Welcome to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society, Janice, and thanks so much for making the time to talk with me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. So, Janice, could you start us off by saying a little bit about your background? What brought you to this field, or rather to the confluence of fields that you work in, visual studies, art history, and history of science?
There are a lot of different fields in there. Well, I was an undergraduate major in history, so I came to this from the field of history originally. And as an undergraduate, I was very interested in art. I took a lot of studio art classes and became interested in larger questions having to do with representation. And that brought me into graduate school in visual studies. So I got my PhD in visual studies from UC Irvine. And while I was there, I got very interested in the field of the history of science because I became interested in the kinds of imagery that that show up in the book, natural history imagery in particular. So kind of a lot of different academic training went into the kinds of questions that I was interested in.
Now, the book focuses on not just natural history images in general, but one particular kind of natural history images, and that's insects. How did you settle on insects as the topic of the study and as your focus for this work?
Well, just such a fun topic was one of them. for the more serious answer was the book started as a dissertation and casting about for a dissertation topic. I was very interested in early modern European images of the natural world, interested in the question of representation, both as a historical topic, art historical topic, and something to do with visual studies and science. And I started thinking about still life paintings a lot because I found them so boring. not knowing too much about still life paintings, I thought, why would anyone make those or study them or have them in their house? They're so boring. They're just these boring pictures. And that, of course, made me realize, wait a second, there's something going on there. I obviously don't know anything about them. So I started thinking about still life paintings, and there's so much literature on still life painting, and it's very complex and very, it's very deep in so many different areas. But I just had the realization that, not too many people talk about these insects that are crawling around the corners of the still life paintings. And that opened up a whole world for me, a whole topic that that I really hadn't known was there. So So still life paintings were the entryway, and then it of course expanded to natural history illustration and specimens and material objects and collections of curiosities, of course, too. That's a big part of it.
Great. And we'll talk about many of these genres in turn as we get into the body of the book, too. So you mentioned just before that this did start off as a dissertation. So could you talk a little bit about that transition? What was the transformation from dissertation to book like for you? Were there any kind of major transformations that needed to happen or major changes? Or what was that process like?
Right. It was definitely painful
for many of us. That's the
case. Yeah. I mean, it was. So the dissertation had four chapters in it, and I knew, interestingly, I guess the still life painting was what really drew me to the topic in the first place. But my dissertation didn't have a chapter on still life painting, again, because it was such a big topic. I think I felt overwhelmed by it. So the dissertation had four chapters without the chapter on still life painting. So I knew that I'd have to write that chapter. And it, so that took me a while to do. That was a completely new chapter, new area for me. And it took a long time to write that because I had to review all that literature and really think about what I wanted to say about still life painting in particular, that could connect to the larger topic of the insects. And other than that, I did the things you're supposed to do. I read the book by William Germano, From Dissertation to Book, which was extremely helpful, and wrote a lot of book proposals to try and figure out what is this going to be? What is a book as compared to a dissertation? Trying to learn about, the narrative, the through line, all of those kinds of things. And what really helped, though, were the external reviewers from the University of Minnesota Press, getting those reader reports back and getting the suggestions for revisions. They were very pointed and very kind of hard to address because they were very, they had very good criticisms and very good suggestions for me, but having to address those and do more research and do more writing. So I think that almost every chapter got rewritten in response to the feedback from the external reviewers, the peer reviewers, and really having to kind of focus the argument and make sure that all the chapters are focused on that idea of, well, so different ideas, but one of the ideas that really came about from the review process was thinking about the persona of the artist as something that needed to be thought about, the persona of the practitioner. And I hadn't really thought about that in the dissertation, but it had been there, but bringing that out and putting it in the forefront with each chapter.
And that does actually wind up being a really central thread throughout the entire book in different ways. So, and we'll definitely talk about that as well. So in the book, you take us through this transformation of the way insects were used over the course of part of early modernity. So prior to the 16th century, you mentioned that insects are included in some visual texts about nature, but they're mostly in the margins, whereas mm-hmm. over the course of the early modern period, they shift from the margins to the center. And it's this shift and the consequences of this shift of insects to the center for helping us rethink the categories of art and science in early modernity, among other things, the persona of practitioners who are working with what we think of as distinct categories, but perhaps what we ought not take for granted are distinct categories, as you show, that really form the basis of the book. So let's get into the nitty-gritty of the book. Now, one of the major, sort of starting from the introduction and where you're laying out some of the basic categories and concepts that are going to be central to how we understand the chapters thereafter and the individual artists and works and notions that those chapters will express for us, in the introduction, you bring up the concept of specimen logic. And this is very important. So specimen logic, you argue, dominated the approach to depicting insects in the early modern period. So to start us off, can you explain this? What is specimen logic? And can you say a little bit about that as it shapes the story here?
Specimen logic, that was another happy development from conversations with editors. That the executive editor that I was working with at University of Minnesota Press actually suggested that phrase to me in conversation about the introduction. And it really made a lot of sense to me, the idea of specimen logic. So specimen logic, it can have a couple of different aspects to it, visual and not visual. But it to me is this process of taking parts of the natural world or things from the natural world and transforming them into specimens. That can happen in visual terms. And the image I use to talk about that a lot in the introduction is the Dürer stag beetle image, that iconic image of the stag beetle kind of rearing its head. It's placed against a very plain white background. It casts a shadow and it has no real markers of its habitat other than this shadow. So it's a piece of nature. It's an animal in this case that has been taken completely out of context and placed into this space of contemplation, a space of study, a space where it can be taken out of whatever context and circulated into different realms. So it happens through this visual image. The other part of it are things that can be, that are familiar to people, you know, talking of who talk about collecting and talk about the history of science in general for this period, which is that idea of nature as an object, nature as something that can be possessed, turning nature into objects and specimens being a particular kind of object.
Now, you mentioned here, or as you just mentioned, images, according to specimen logic, are increasingly decontextualized. They're taken out of their original habitats and they're entered into networks of circulation and also of exchange. Now, the notion of exchange is also something that comes up right at the beginning of the book, and it's something that remains extraordinarily central to the argument of the rest of the chapters in the book. You argue here for us to understand exchange not just in terms of physical movements, but also virtual movements and virtual practices. So can you say a little bit about the centrality of exchange, how you understand exchange as it's shaping the way you're thinking about these phenomena? And can you say a little bit about this notion of not just physical exchange, but virtual exchange as it's shaping the story?
Yeah, I mean, virtual exchange, I think that runs the, I use that as a central organizing concept for one of the chapters that on Thomas Moffat and Ulysses Aldrovandi. And I struggled with that a bit because, of course, it can be an anachronistic term. It's, you know, the idea of virtual specimens and virtual collections is something that we're more familiar with as present day people rather than that being the terms that 16th century people might have used. But it was a term that was very useful for me for thinking about exchange. And just as you say, people who were both exchanging objects and sending specimens to one another over small geographical areas within Europe, but also to non-European locations and receiving specimens from non-European locations. So there's that, you know, specimens and images work somewhat interchangeably in that situation. But then also within individual collections and within the thinking of individual practitioners, it seems like there is a loosening that can happen, a loosening of thought and a loosening of categories that happens in the very construction of those categories. So insects seem like a good focus for the way that mentally people can begin to take the natural world apart, parse it into individual parts, parse it into sections that are made to be exchanged or made to be entered into circulation. So I kind of get wrapped up in in talking about both the differences between images and objects and the ways that they don't have differences between them sometimes. And it's not always clear to me sometimes what we're talking about. Is it an image or an object?
And I think this actually speaks to a larger kind of work and a really important kind of work that the book does on many levels, and again, throughout the study. It's not just images and objects, rather, represent one of several kind of binaries, almost, that we tend to take for granted. And then it seems that you're arguing here that this looking at this particular context, looking at not just early modernity, but the ways that insects are used as a kind of a tool for reshaping artistic personas and the categories that they are bleeding into, this all helps us perhaps challenge what we take for granted as binary. So images and objects being one of those, but also you're talking about the sort of recrafting the binary between perhaps professional and amateur artists or professional and amateur practitioners. And also more broadly or at a kind of major meta level, art and science.
Right. Yeah, that's what came to mind too. I think that you're right. And that's a helpful way to describe it too, because I think sometimes in my own thinking in writing this book and speaking about the subject matter, that these binaries can be confusing. just the ones that you listed, they can be confusing when you're actually trying to think through what the images are doing and how people are using them, how people are making them. And so, you start to introduce a third term often, and you start wondering, well, if it's a binary, how do I get that third term in there? So, you know, an example of this is, Albrecht Dürer could be one, or Urs Hufnagel, who we'll talk about with chapter one, but that going back to that stag beetle image, is it an image or an object? Why does it have to be one or the other? It's an image of an object. It's an object in itself. The drawing itself is an object. The materiality of the paint on the paper, that starts to be both image and object at the same time. And so I think you're right about the binaries being taken for granted, but at the same time, they're really important to structure how you start to think about these things and in your approach. But also within the image object, professional, amateur, art and science ultimately was something that I often struggle with as a set of categories in which to fit these items. But also the question of observation, what's happening with observation and how are you observing nature when you're looking at an image like the stag beetle image, say, are you replicating a series of observations that an artist made, or are you being brought along a path that the artist is constructing for you, which is not necessarily the same path as he or she might have taken in making their own observations. So it's complicated, and that's why I love it.
And it's sort of you make the point in the book that just taking one of these binaries, the opposition between art and science is a product of rhetoric, right? That was actually actively designed to serve the purpose of certain individuals. And I think what you're bringing into the conversation is also that there's a kind of visual rhetoric.
Right.
That's another way for us to think about the ways that these artists are actively kind of manipulating the way their audiences and the way we are thinking about these categories in their choice of how to depict these insects.
Right. I think that idea of the visual rhetoric is a really important one. And it brings us back to why the subject matter and, you know, what is different about these images of insects that I've chosen in this book, as opposed to botanical imagery or images of other parts of the natural world. And I think that the reason I use the insect as a way to enter into a conversation about that visual rhetoric is because they do carry with them certain types of visual practices that are really important to the things that we've been talking about. Like, why is an image of an insect able to be entered into the context of being exchanged in the context of a collection of rarities? It's because of the visual rhetoric that is used in some ways, meaning extreme delicacy of execution of the drawing. The use of bright colors in the paint, the use of precious materials. If it's painted on vellum, if it's painted with special paper, fancy paper, for lack of a better term, those kinds of elements of visual rhetoric, I think, are really central to this too, or I try to make them central to it.
So let's get right into the examples that you give us in the body chapters. The book is separated into two parts, and part one of the book looks at the emergence of insects as subject matter. So the book itself is organized both thematically and chronologically, and part one consists of three chapters that are focused roughly around the period 1580 to 1620. And then when we get to part two, then we'll get to later on in the 17th century. So the emergence of insects as subject matter in part one is interwoven with the crafting of identities around insects in three types of materials: illuminated manuscripts, natural history illustrations, and early still life painting. Chapter one brings us into the work of someone who you've just mentioned, Joris Hufnagel, who is a Flemish artist who did really arresting and just fascinating work that involved both what we might call real, and I'm using sort of air scare quotes here for listeners, insects, but also imaginary insects. So I can't wait to talk about him. So can you talk a little bit about Hufnagel? Who is he, and why, what about his work fascinated you? And can you talk about him in the context of this study?
Right. Yeah. Hufnagel is an artist who I was just very taken with going back to graduate school and coming up with seminar paper topics, and also getting to read the extremely wonderful work on him by the scholar Lee Hendricks, who is a curator at the Getty and has written and wrote an amazing dissertation on Joris Hufnagel's Four Elements, which is a series of manuscript paintings that he did, not just about insects, but also about other parts of the natural world. And I became really interested in his amazing manuscript that the Getty also holds, which is known as the Mira Calligraphia Monumenta, which is a model book of calligraphy that was a collaboration between Hufnagel and an artist who he never met, the calligrapher George Boschkai. And it's this incredible book that is just, you know, it's fairly small, but it is just full of the most amazing imagery and the most amazing examples of calligraphy. And what I discovered, I just wasn't my own discovery by far, but what I found out, or I noticed when I was reading the facsimile, was that so many of the insects were identified by the scholars who were compiling the facsimile as imaginary insects, but there wasn't much discussion of the imaginary insects. So that was really how I got hooked on Hufnagel, to put it in that strange way. Why would an artist make imaginary insects, and why would an artist create imaginary insects that were so real looking, so immersed in that visual rhetoric of realism, of naturalism, of making things look real, that they are so real that they would fool your eye if you weren't a careful or attentive observer. So I think I got seduced by the quality of the images, just as a 16th century viewer was meant to.
Now, the chapter uses Hufnagel's work and this particular aspect of his work that you're talking about to explore the notion of order as elaborated in the work of Foucault, and in particular Foucault's description of epistemes in the order of things. So what I'd love to, if you could do for us, is to talk about two aspects of this. First, can you talk about the centrality of Foucault, especially his work in the order of things, to the way you're thinking about these phenomena and this chapter in particular? And in particular, you mentioned the importance of screening as a notion that shaped Hufnagel's work and his decision of how to work with insects. So can you talk about those things for us? So why Foucault? Why is Foucault central here? And also screening in particular. What is that? And can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, well, going back to the idea of the transition from dissertation to book, I think that these are probably the most leftover parts from that graduate school process. Not that they're not super important to me, but Foucault was a writer who I struggled with in graduate school, as most people do when reading Foucault, but who I loved and struggled with, but also got really confused reading about his ideas about natural history. Most of those ideas in the order of things are focused on 18th century materials, but really trying to take those ideas seriously when looking at the 16th century. And it just seemed like there were these functions happening that he talks about with screens cleaning and focusing on very small parts of the natural world in order to create order. And that's sort of what he talks about with screening. But that seemed to be happening, from what I could see, very early, at least in the images. So Foucault was a really important touchstone for me for thinking through some of the larger questions that I was interested in. And screening also, you know, I don't think it comes out in the book, but that was, so the concept comes from Foucault and I use it in a certain way in the book, but it was also a really important conceptual idea that I got in graduate school by studying with a film studies scholar, the late Anne Friedberg, who wrote about screens a lot. She talked about the concept of the screen in visual culture and in film in particular. So, you know, trying to think about how to conceptualize that ordering process that is so dependent on narrowing things down and taking very small parts of nature to represent a whole, but at the same time, why those processes might have been masked. Why were they supposed to be taken for granted or taken as reality? So Hufnagel is an artist whose visual images really do that to an extreme. They take just the most specialized parts of the natural world, turn them into these beautiful visual images, to turn them into these beautiful visual objects, which appear to be resting on these pages that are filled with amazing calligraphy and the most intricate imagery. But at the same time, we're not, as a viewer, you're not supposed to be made aware of those processes. So I think that's the kind of the long answer to why Foucault and how Foucault connects to that.
Great. Now, who was Hufnagel's intended audience, and how did that shape his decisions about how to depict these insects?
Hufnagel was an artist who worked for the elite. The manuscript, the Mare Calligraphia Monumenta, which is the work that contains the imaginary insects, that was made for the Emperor Rudolf II. And Hufnagel never actually moved to Prague. He was in the service of the emperor, but he worked elsewhere. I don't know as much as I'd like to about that, his working practices, but this manuscript that I've been talking about was a collaboration between Hufnagel and the calligrapher that happened without them ever knowing one another, because the manuscript was in the possession of Rudolf II, had the calligraphy put in it or made for it. And then some years later, the manuscript was given to Hufnagel to work on. So he was definitely working for this particular audience, very elite, very educated people, the emperor and the people around him who were interested in rarities, who were interested in collecting nature, of course, that whole side of things. So it was an audience who needed to be wowed. They needed to be connected with on a fairly sophisticated level.
Now, as we move into the next chapter of the book, we move into two other figures who form the central basis for this chapter. Chapter two moves from looking at sort of one central figure to bringing our attention explicitly to communities, and to communities in particular of artists, artisans, and naturalists that coalesced around the study of insects and natural history, in particular in the work of two figures and the kind of communities that they embodied and that they marshaled for their work. These two figures are Aldrovandi and Moffat. So these two figures, they're one of the things that you bring out here that was very important to both of them is that they both were trained as physicians. Mm-hmm. And medicine, as you're arguing here, in really, really interesting ways influenced the way they decided to visually depict insects. So can you talk a little bit for us about these figures? How did Aldrovandi and Moffat how did their background in medicine shape the way they decided to approach insects as subject matter in this context?
Right. Aldrovandi was trained in medicine, and as was Moffat. And I think that because they were both working in medicine in the late 16th century, when medical practice was experiencing a profound change in the way that people were trained, as well as how people were thinking about it, that materia medica was a really important part of medical training at this time. So studying plants, collecting plants, becoming familiar with botany generally, and not relying necessarily so much on theory. And I mean, I know that this, theory of Galen, the Galenists and the non-Galenists, that was an important debate. But I think and history of medicine is not my primary field, of course, so other people have examined this in much better detail. But just generally, this interest in collecting nature and working with the materials of nature in both botanical gardens as well as botanical collecting, I think that seems to be where they entered into that world of collecting nature and working with nature in a material way, in a material practice. I think that insects for both of them were because they fell outside of that kind of practice, might have posed a challenge and an opportunity, and also presented an opportunity to say something new about something, about an aspect of the natural world. So because botany had such a rich tradition already in the later 16th century, insects had something to offer that was outside of that. So it's kind of a fertile research area for both of them.
Right. And one of the really interesting things that this chapter does is that you're showing the ways in which images and collections of images, so here focusing on insects, really came to function as specimens, so as virtual specimens and specimen cabinets. Now, the way that this works, and one of the central notions that you introduce in this chapter in order to take us through this process, is the notion of cutting and pasting. This is a central motif. So can you explain how cutting and pasting works in this context? How, in what ways was this important for Aldrovandi and Moffat?
Yeah, and I mean, another possibly anachronistic term, but very useful for me for thinking about what was happening with both of these authors. One thing that the larger interest that I had in writing this chapter was in the relationship between drawings and their published versions in printed books, and getting to look at original drawings and seeing how that transition happens when they're translated into woodcut and the printed page, the published work. So that was one way that images would travel or would be cut and paste virtually, that they would be cut out of a different context and to be assembled into the page, the confines of the page of a printed book. But, you know, in other ways, images could function as these virtual specimens, being able to be worked with in ways that actual specimens couldn't. They could show different angles of the same specimen, so front and back, if necessary. That's what we see a lot in the Aldrovandi notebooks. There's images of the front and the back of a particular specimen, and so that's a view that you couldn't show with just if you just had one specimen of the insect. And so, the idea of moving things around, being able to move, physically work with specimens or images that were standing in for specimens, moving them around within the pages of a notebook in order to order the emerging concept of the insect world, putting things into categories, changing those categories as necessary.
And that was actually really interesting. I mean, one of the interesting things that's happening in this chapter is that you, as an author, are actually, and forgive me if I'm misinterpreting this, but you're actually reconstructing the layout of a page,
yeah.
Right? So in talking about Aldrovandi's use of this cutting and pasting and the way this actually shaped his own classification of insects, you're actually bringing to bear your own cutting and pasting, right? Your own processes.
Right.
So can you say a little bit about that, about sort of your reconstruction of this page of Aldrovandi? What did that involve for you? And I would just love to hear more about that.
Yeah, that was really fun. It was sort of uncutting and unpasting what happened. So I for my dissertation research, I went to Bologna and I got to go through the notebooks of Aldrovandi that are at the University of Bologna. And it's just, you know, the most wonderful thing to get to have the time to go through them. And I just sort of went through and transcribed everything, all of the notations about insects, to try and figure out, you know, there were these lists of the images that were completed, and lists of where certain images were in the notebooks, and then comparing them to the printed page. And there's just this long, long list, and just transcribing and trying to match up where they went. And I noticed that, well, wait, this doesn't, it was not matching up. And so I realized that this plate, and let me see what image we're talking about here. I don't know if you have it in front of you.
I think it's page 37.
Thank you. Yeah, 38 maybe. So I realized that there was one page that kept being referred to in the notebooks, and I wasn't finding it printed page. So it was kind of a convoluted story, but what I figured out was that originally this image on page 38, figure 2.2, it had pictures of some butterflies, some moths, dragonflies, and then this insect in the middle of the page, which was something that he didn't seem to know what it was. So he called it an insect in the form of a locust, but it combined different qualities to it. Papilio locustiformis, so a butterfly in the form of a locust. So this was basically a first draft of an image that would end up not being in the book. And because what he did eventually was he decided to put all of these insects in different categories. It seemed like at this stage he was categorizing them all as winged insects, but then winged insects got broken down into another category of butterflies in a separate category, dragonflies being put in a separate chapter, and then the winged insect in the form of a locust, that just got put in the back because in a sort of a catch-all for insects that he couldn't figure out what category they should be in. So what I think happened is that based on this reconstruction, this was the original appearance of the woodcut. When Aldrovandi changed his categories or further refined them, he actually had the artisan break the woodcut apart, cut it apart, and use the different sections of that actual wood plate in different parts of the book. So they got cut apart and pasted virtually or recombined with other images throughout the book to be in their correct or quote unquote correct places.
Now, as we move, and I'll mention for listeners, if, in case I haven't mentioned this already, that the image that we're just talking about here, which was actually, again, I'm sorry for 37, it was actually on 38, you're right. This is one of many really beautiful images in the book. And so I wish that we had the opportunity to virtually project these for listeners. But this is perhaps a reason for listeners, go out, buy the book, because it's full of not just really interesting ideas, but really, really beautiful. Many, very beautiful images of these works. So speaking of beautiful images, as we move into the next chapter, we move to the chapter that you mentioned earlier was actually something that you added to the book in the transition from the dissertation to the manuscript, and that is a chapter on still life painting. So at the turn of the 17th century, artists begin to include insects, which is a relatively new subject, into this relatively new genre of still life painting. Now, you mentioned in this chapter that these paintings, again, moving to the issue of audiences and readership, as we talked about in the case of Hufnagel, these mostly had courtly and elite audiences, and that actually shaped the way insects were depicted in the paintings. You mention here, you take us through a really wonderful account of collecting in cabinets of curiosities to show the ways that artists invoked the visual tropes from those contexts into the way they're depicting insects in order to satisfy the audience's tastes for collections and these rare objects and collectibles. So can you talk a little bit about that? How did this context of this larger context within sort of collections and cabinets of curiosities in which you're situating these still life paintings shape the way insects appear in this relatively new genre?
Yeah, and So the still life paintings, one thing that I had to figure out when trying to figure out how I'd address still life painting was, well, what period of still life painting? Dutch still life painting of the 17th century is what we know more about. There's a lot more of those paintings. But Flemish still life painting of the earlier part, the late 16th century and the earlier part of the 17th century, it's a little bit smaller of a field and smaller of a genre. It doesn't have that same, and it didn't have that same patronage aspect as you were talking about. It was in the early days of the formation of this genre, and as you said, it was for mostly courtly and elite audiences. The 17th century still life painting that we associate with the Dutch Golden Age and the expansion of the art market into upper or upper middling incomes and away from an exclusively courtly or church, an elite patronage structure. That wasn't quite the context for these paintings. So that was helpful for me when I finally realized, oh, these still life paintings that insects are starting to appear in around 1600, that's a very different context. And as you were saying, that audience shaped the taste for insects. And so I was trying to figure out, well, if you look at a still life painting from this period, insects often appear in them. But what else do insects appear with? Well, they seem to appear with shells and sometimes with coins. And of course, the beautiful bouquets of flowers that are the central focus of most of the paintings that we're talking about. And so how did that context shape how insects were depicted? Well, one example, and again, I'll take a visual example. It's on page 84. It's a painting by Balthasar van der Ast, who was part of the family of the, or part of the circle of Flemish painters who were active in this period. And he often had insects in his paintings. In this painting, there's a central, luscious, gorgeous bouquet of exotic flowers, tulips, roses, all kinds of different flowers that bloom at different times of year. This is something that scholars on still life painting have noted, and it's a really important part of what's happening here. I can't remember, I think it's a katydid on the left of the bouquet, and it's taking us, it has this long, slender, pointed body, and it's placed right next to a shell that has the same kind of tapering body, and they're obviously meant to be seen together, the viewer's meant to explore those visually, note the patterns that are, note the shapes that are similar, think about the way that the textures might be similar, the hard shell of the insect paralleling the hard, shiny shell of that exotic object next to it. And so thinking about that context, thinking about the ways that artists would choose insects to appeal to the tastes of collectors, they would do much the same thing that Hufnagel was doing in the pages of his illuminated manuscripts, choosing insects that were beautiful, had contained beautiful patterning or beautiful colors, or had particularly complex shapes about them that would serve as good vehicles for displaying artistic skill, and also visually interesting, that would benefit from shapes that would, or forms that would benefit from extended looking and extended visual contemplation or study. The other big part of the chapter does try and look at the artistic lineage that insects were sort of brought into, that there was a tradition of depicting shells as well as flowers, again, in the botanical context, as well as the other context of books of flowers and images of flowers. And that's another aspect of the chapter.
But the image that you just invoked, and in the way you invoked it, sort of describing the importance of the placing of the insect and the shells and the petals sort of next to each other, it really also evokes the importance of juxtaposition that comes out in literature on cabinets of curiosities, right? Where it's right. Very important, not just what's in the cabinets, but how they're ordered. And it seems like for very similar reasons to what you're describing in these still life paintings. That's really interesting.
Yeah, and all, and you know, all of the amazing literature on collecting in the early modern period and cabinets of curiosity, all of that was, you know, reading all of that really came into these considerations of still life. And going back to that concept that you brought up earlier, the idea of the binary and struggling against the binary categorization here, you know, the still life paintings did that for me too. They function at the same time as they're functioning as a two-dimensional visual image. They are, they're also, oh, am I still in there? Sorry.
Yeah, yep,
you can still hear me. Sorry, my computer did something weird. So at the same time that they're functioning as a two-dimensional image, they are at the same time a three-dimensional image that is subject to collecting. So a part of the chapter talks about early, you know, 16th century still life paintings that functioned as panels in actual cabinets of curiosities or panels in other kinds of furniture that would have housed perhaps apothecary jars or kind of precious natural substances of some type.
Now, as we move from this context to part two of the book, we move to later in the 17th century. So part two considers a context in which insects are no longer new subjects, as they are in the cases that constitute the chapters in part one, but they're still exotic. And they're exotic objects in particular around which practitioners are developing new identities, new professional personae, and new visual strategies. So this set of contexts in part two takes us into the ways that a handful of artists, in particular two figures, Hook and Marion, engage with the importance of exchange and global commerce, and also engage with the decorative arts in different ways. So chapter four focuses on the work of Robert Hooke. Now, Hooke is famous for his work Micrographia, and the Micrographia and images from the Micrographia may be familiar to listeners. But one of the really exciting things in this chapter is that you've also found what you argue is another set of sketches that were previously unattributed, but that are actually done by Hooke. And they let us really kind of see the transition from observation and sketch to the published images in the Micrographia in a totally new way. So this was super exciting for me. Can you talk a little bit, can you talk about this sketchbook and these previously unattributed sketches and tell us a little bit about them and their importance for this story?
Right. I mean, that was so exciting for me too, for the reasons you were talking about, and to go back to my interest when we were talking about Alder, Vondi, and Moffat, being able to compare original drawings to published drawings is so interesting and important too when trying to think about how different writers or practitioners are using visual images to think through concepts, larger concepts too. So yeah, so this notebook, it's in the British Library, and it is mostly known for the sketches that were done a little bit later in the early 18th century by a man named John Covell, who was an Englishman who traveled abroad and used this notebook to, he traveled mostly to the Middle East, I think, and used the notebook to sketch and make notes about a lot about insects. But somehow, you know, I was just looking through it at the advice of, I think it was Bill Sherman, who had said, oh, you're interested in insects. There's this notebook by John Covell. It has insects in it. So I just was looking at it. And I had been really deeply engaged with the Micrographia as well because of the subject matter. I knew I had to say something about that book. It had a lot of pictures of insects, and it was really important. And so paging through the Covell, I came across these pages that just didn't fit the style. They didn't look like the rest of the drawings. And they were clearly done in an earlier hand. And one image in particular caught my eye. So there's a page of the notebook, which is reproduced on page 126 of the book. It's figure 4.8. And I was looking at that, and the insect in the lower right corner really caught my eye. And I thought, I've seen that before. I've seen that before. Where have I seen that before? And I realized, oh, I've seen it in Hook. I've seen, I know that that insect is in Hook's book. And so that was the realization. It was kind of like, oh, I'd been reading the right thing at the right time. I had been reading Hook. So that's why I was able to recognize this one insect. And so what I figured out was, even if you, I think it's legible in the image here, but at the very, very corner of that inscription next to the insect, he says that is a kind of tick found creeping upon paper. You can see the initials RH there. It's dated April, I think it's April 11th, 1661 RH. So I thought, whoa, Robert Hooke, obviously. And, you know, it wasn't until later that I was trying to figure out, well, what am I going to write about with Hook? And I should look at the original drawings for the micrographia. Obviously, I didn't realize until later that, oh, they're not available. You know, they don't exist anymore. So that really got me excited about this image, that, oh, it's one of the few preparatory drawings or early sketches that we have that we can link to the later famous published images.
So how did Hook transform his observations from the sketches to the published work in micrographia? Can you talk a little bit about what are some of the substantial changes, and how are those changes important for what this chapter is doing?
Mm-hmm. It gets back to that larger question of persona, which is really a huge focus of this chapter in particular. Well, what I discovered was that not only did this page have sketches of insects viewed through the microscope by Robert Hooke, but throughout the inscriptions, there are also other initials here, DC, there's ET, other people seem to have been collaborating with Hooke when he was doing these observations. And if you look at the associated entries in the published version of micrographia, there doesn't seem to be any mention of these other people making observations. So that was very, very interesting that when this eventually went to print, and these are not preparatory drawings, I should say that these are just early sketches. But when these eventually went into print, Hook at that point excised these references to other people in order to present himself as a sole observer. And the reasons for that, or a solitary observer, and the reasons for that are numerous. One being his position at the Royal Society at the time that the book was published, as opposed to this earlier moment when he was working collaboratively with other people, wasn't presenting the research in the context of the Royal Society, and might not have needed to have that authority vested completely in his own persona, that wouldn't have been a problem earlier because he wasn't presenting to the Royal Society. It wouldn't have been a problem that he was collaborating with other people and relying on other people's observations. But later, when he had this more fraught, let's say, social professional position where his observations needed to be his own, they no longer appear in the published version. The other thing that happens, of course, visually is that he makes revisions to the image. But what was really interesting about this tick, or the crab-like insect, as it's referred to in his book, is that in the entry in the book, in micrographia, he states that I only saw this insect once. So he constructs this whole story, or he relates this whole story about how he was sitting in his study and this insect happened upon the page and it skittered across the page, and being very observant and being always at the ready, I took out my microscope and I looked at it and I observed it, and here's its beautiful form. It looks like gold, and all this beautiful description of the insect's body. But he does say, I only met with it once. So to me, I mean, I've been in conversations with other scholars about of Hook's life since then who've been asking, well, maybe he did see it again. And I can see that maybe that was a literary construction and he maybe did get to make other observations of the insect. But that does connect it pretty clearly to this preliminary sketch in the sketchbook that I noticed. And there are differences between them. So at the very least, it shows, well, he's making revisions, he's constructing his final images, and definitely revising and redoing them for the context of print. So it's just another example of how practitioners in the early modern period often use this rhetoric and visual as well as literary rhetoric of being just the amanuensis of the microscope, or just an observer who is not interfering with the phenomena they're observing. But there's many, many different layers of the conveyance of the observation that take place.
And you describe this this rhetoric that Hooke uses as a way for him to generate a sense of trust among his readers. And this was something that was also of a concern to the final central figure in the final body chapter of the book. And this is Maria Sibylla Marion. She was also interested in different ways and perhaps using different kinds of materials. She was interested in convincing her audiences that her observations are trustworthy. Now, Marion is a really interesting figure. You take us through her early story. It's a way to situate her major work. She divorces her husband. She moves with her two daughters and her mom to a Lovatist religious community. She then leaves the community. She moves to Amsterdam. She goes to Suriname with one of her daughters. It's a really, really interesting story. But what the great thing about this chapter, though, is you're using this story to situate what goes on to be a really detailed and really interesting study of her work. And of the images and the context for the creation of those images. Now, I'd love to hear, as we sort of come to this final chapter, if you could speak a little bit to the importance of the different kinds of genres that she's working on in this chapter, which again brings up the recurring theme of sort of urging us to not think in these binaries. One of the things that you're showing here is that art, including the decorative arts and science, were really intertwined in Marion's practice rather than being central concerns. And in fact, her background in embroidery and needlework and the decorative arts shapes the way she depicts specimens in natural history drawings. So could you say something about this? Marion and her work as a sort of hybrid art science figure, and the importance of the decorative arts in shaping her depictions.
Marion is such an interesting figure, and all of her biographical background make her a favorite for many scholars of early modern women's history, history of science also, and her biography has been explored by a lot of different scholars. Natalie Zeman Davis's biography is, fascinating for all the detail that it presents about her. And so Marion herself is just sort of intrinsically interesting because of her life. And but one of the questions that I had was, well, the different parts of her life seem to be talked about differently depending on the scholar's point of view. For historians of science, it seems like, well, her later work in her book on the insects of Suriname, that seems to be the more scientifically important book. Whereas scholars of women's history talk more about her earlier work and, the way that she was embedded in training of women, education of women in needlework and embroidery design, and how she came from that context. And for me, the question was, well, trying to think about Marion's visual output as a whole, how can we reconcile what she's doing later in the so-called more scientific publication of the book about the insects of Suriname? How can that be thought of as a whole with the earlier work that she's doing that's usually categorized as her needlework books or her patterns? And there's other work along the way too that she did a very important book on the caterpillars of Europe that kind of straddles both of those. So I was really just trying to figure out, well, how can we talk about her work as a whole when we're thinking about if the focus is on those visual images and how she's using particular visual strategies. So my point was just, I think the argument that I made was just that it seems like she's using similar visual strategies in both the early work as well as the later work. So it doesn't make sense to categorize one as solely having to do with art and decorative arts and one as solely having to do with science if they're both using similar visual strategies. So some of those visual strategies are related back to the idea of specimen logic and the ways that decontextualizing parts of the natural world in order to make them be able to enter into the context of circulation and exchange, how that happens visually. So in the earlier work, the needlework patterns, it seems like Marion is really trying to present the elements in a very clear, unobstructed way so that they can be translated by embroiderers and people working with fabric and thread into designs that can use these elements in a very recognizable way. At the same time, there are what we would describe as decorative elements. In other words, you know, scrolling stems, very balanced compositions meant to use all of the space on the page in a very elegant and as well as economical way. So when we I think we see those same kinds of visual strategies happening in the later work that she produces, The Insects of Suriname, very crisp edges, very decoratively laid out compositions, lots of concern for elegance and harmony and balance in those images, in similar ways to what we see in her early work.
And another thing, because I don't want to keep you for too long, I won't ask you to go into detail about this, but I just want to mention for listeners who might be interested in the themes of commerce and exchange, those are very much, those are very central to a lot of the chapters in this book. But in particular, you're showing in this chapter, I'll just mention this for listeners, that Marion was also involved in the trade and exchange of specimens, of natural history specimens, in Amsterdam during the late 17th century. And that also, you talk about the ways that that also shapes her development as an artist. So again, another one of these major threads of the book, no pun intended, talking about embroidery, but pun sort of intended. So, but the thread of commerce and exchange as being central to her artistic development.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because one could argue that Marion was first and foremost a businesswoman. She didn't come from wealth. She had to support herself, and her research was self-funded. Her research trips were self-funded, and she really had to be attentive to what could sell. And that's a part of the chapter on Marion also, that that I argue that she's constructing these images with a particular audience in mind as well. She was familiar with the collections in Amsterdam, had visited them, and knew what her audience was looking for. So the images in her Suriname book are definitely geared towards that. But she had to make a living, and she had to, you know, she had to support herself, and it was a business. And there's, you know, she's got such a fascinating figure, but her daughters end up returning to South America, and one of the daughter's husbands also, and setting up a business where they're sending specimens back for selling in Europe.
Well, so Janice, this has been really interesting for me. I think as we come to the close, because I don't want to keep you for 2 hours, although we could, I'll mention also just before we close up, there's also a concluding chapter. So for listeners and readers who are interested in the way the shape of these kinds of phenomena changes over the course of later natural history, so 18th and 19th century, you show in that chapter the ways that the emergence of Linnaean taxonomy actually transforms the way insects are depicted in later work. So it sort of pushes us forward into future possible directions for exploring this topic. Now, we talked about a lot of the book, but there's a ton of the book that we didn't have a chance to talk about. It's extraordinarily rich, and there's a lot of detail. Is there anything else in particular that we didn't cover, but that you'd like to mention, especially for listeners who may not yet have had a chance to read it?
I think we covered a lot of it there. I'll just kind of have a concluding thought, and it's actually not about my book, but about another person's book that I'm reading. I'm currently reading the book Picturing the Book of Nature, Sachiko Kusakawa's book, and I've been thinking a lot about print because of that book. And so I think just, you know, thinking about and connecting it back to my book, I'm very interested in that transition to print and the kinds of constraints, both intellectual and material, that happen when knowledge or observations, either of nature or of the natural world or other things, have to be put down on paper. we do it ourselves as scholars, but what's happening in that transition, as you have to put things down on paper. I'll just briefly mention one little anecdote from the chapter on Aldrovandi and Moffat. We were talking about community and the community, the virtual community around those two publications. But in the end, I noticed, well, there was a kind of a fracturing of community there too, in that Moffat seems to have lifted Aldrovandi's images of silkworms and not attributed them to him either. So it's the same image in both books, but doesn't seem to note the source of the image. And of course, there's a lot going on with copying, etc. there. But I thought, I wonder, did think about that more in the context of having to print and having to publish and having to establish authority through this new medium of print, and how that affects how people think about their work and how, what they're going to do with both images and text.
So speaking of what people are going to do with images and text, yes. now that the book is out, and congratulations, what's next for you? What project is currently inspiring you? What can we look forward to reading next or in the undisclosed future?
Right. Well, I'm at the very wonderful point of getting to just think very broadly and explore different avenues. I've got very interested in that connection between science and the decorative arts that we were just talking about with Marion. So I'm hoping to work more on that in the 16th century and 17th century materials. I have some other publications that deal with those topics, the topic of decorative arts and science in the 18th century. So I'm hoping to look more into the earlier connections between those two areas. The work I've done the most on, or the most reading on, is the early 17th century in France, and looking at some connections between the royal embroiderers in early 17th century France and the construction of the botanical gardens there too, and what they had in common. So science and the decorative arts seems to be where I'm hoping to explore more.
Sounds great. And so yeah. Thank you so much for making the time to talk with us. This was really fun, and best of luck with your new work.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure to get to talk about my book, and thank you so much.
You've been listening to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll see you next time.